Vous êtes à l'écoute de
Hey everybody, I'm Anna.
And I'm Alex.
And this is Mosaic, a podcast about immigration from the Publix Radio. Alex, do you know who Maxim Litvinov was?
I don't. Vodka maker?
No. He's somebody I learned about from my Uber driver, and he was actually a Soviet revolutionary. He was Joseph Stalin's right-hand man for decades, and my driver's namesake.
My father named me Guillermo, because that's his name, Litvinov. So he used to be a Soviet diplomat. My youngest brother's name is Jose, but the story behind him is that my father wanted to name him Stalin, and my mom did not like that name, so he named it Jose.
This is Guillermo. Guillermo Litvinov Perez. When he's not driving, he's making beats in his basement apartment. Guillermo is also a Dominican immigrant from Providence.
And Providence is a really Dominican town.
That's right. Rhode Island is actually the only state in the whole country where Dominicans are the largest Latino group.
It's interesting that Dominicans started settling in New England as an alternative to New York, really starting in the 1970s, at a time when this region had tons of mills and factories, which meant jobs. And the community keeps growing today, even though the mill jobs are mostly gone.
And Guillermo's story starts off like that of many other Dominican immigrants. He comes here as a kid in a big, close-knit family. But there's nothing typical about where this story goes. I'm sitting in Guillermo's basement apartment. Aside from his makeshift music studio with keyboards, microphones, and monitors, there's not much to his home. In place of a kitchen, there's a mini fridge and a microwave. And off to the side, there's a door to his bedroom. Guillermo spends most of his time driving for Uber to make money.
I'm doing decent with that. A lot of people don't know how much money you could do with that. You can make if you figure it out.
I met Guillermo when he was my Uber driver. I got in the car on the way home from dinner with friends, and I saw in the app that my driver's name was Guillermo. So I say, "Hey, Guillermo." And he says,
"Where are you from?"
Yeah. He said, "Where are you from?" Because you said my name.
Too perfect. I said, "Too perfect." Not just perfect, but too perfect. Yeah.
I tell him I'm Puerto Rican, that's why I say his name too perfect. He says he's Dominican, and we start talking. He asks me what I do for a living, and I tell him I'm working on this podcast about immigration. And he literally says, "I got a story." For the rest of the ride home, he tells me the story you're about to hear, and it blows my mind.
I was a dreamer before the dreamers, you could say.
Guillermo first immigrated with his family to New York from the Dominican Republic in 1988. He was 8 years old. They moved from New York to Providence not long after that.
And with all the factory jobs here, I can see why they would do that. By then, there were thousands of Dominican families here in Providence coming for the same reason.
And I should say that they came to this country on visas, but the visas ran out. So Guillermo and his family were technically here illegally, and that's a really important point for the rest of the story. So Guillermo's family is part of this huge Dominican community living in Providence. It's not easy when they first get here. His mom gets hurt in a car accident soon after they arrive, but his family gets an insurance settlement, and they start a business.
Right away, if we go 408 Cranston Street, that's like a little restaurant now that used to be our house. We used to have a grocery store right there. My parents actually ended up buying that house and had a grocery store right there. Jose's Mini Market.
Named after Joseph Stalin?
Unfortunately, no, it was somebody else. But Guillermo and his brothers work in the store throughout middle and high school. Life is simple. Go to school, come home, work in the store. But Guillermo has big dreams.
Ain't baseball diamonds, siced out medallions, gangster Italian, films the attraction, male figures.
When I was 10 years old, I knew I wanted to be a drug dealer.
So Guillermo's dream is to be a drug dealer.
Yeah, because to him, success was money. And because Guillermo is essentially here illegally, he doesn't have the same opportunities to make it big. And he kept seeing his neighbors and kids his own age go from being broke, like him, to having a new car, the hottest sneakers. And he wants what they have, fast money.
But then his family moves, so he can't realize his dream.
Yeah, his family moves back to the Dominican Republic. From ages 16 to 19, Guillermo lives in the DR because his dad is working in politics there. But Guillermo really wants to come back to Providence, and his parents are thinking along the same lines. Being in the DR gives Guillermo's family a chance to make things legal again. His mother applies for U.S. citizenship in 1997, and she gets it. It's an expensive process, though, so she can only afford to get Guillermo and his brothers legal permanent resident status in 1999, when Guillermo is 19.
So Guillermo, his mother, and his younger brother can enter into the U.S. legally.
Which they do. They come back to Providence soon after that.
Everything was just different. You know, everybody had like a different state of mind.
He had to get used to Rhode Island all over again. The climate, the quiet, and his friends have changed.
Matter of fact, I'm going to tell you a story. The day after I came back, I'm not going to say who, but I was with a friend of mine, and we went to go see another friend. And when we went in the house, he had like 10 pounds of weed on the table, and I had just come from the Dominican Republic. And I remember that I had never seen that before in my life. Not that much. So I'm like, damn. So I'm like, yo, man, we get out of here.
That's the summer of 1999. 19-year-old Guillermo is hanging with friends, but he can't get a job. He tries for over a year and nothing. One of his friends is in the Marine Corps, and he tells Guillermo that he should think about enlisting.
So I remember telling him, like, yo, because we was about to go back to Japan. It was like January. He came back in December, actually. And I'm like, yo, if I'm still in this summer situation, I'm going to join the military somehow.
Months pass, and Guillermo still doesn't have a job. His mom is in and out of the picture at this point, so more and more the bills are falling on Guillermo to pay. He starts what he calls hustling, selling small amounts of weed, doing favors for friends.
So it sounds like he's kind of in survival mode.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's looking for the best way to get a quick buck. One day, he's at the barbershop with his friend, and he hears a way he can make a huge amount of money.
And the guy said, well, nah, I'm in the National Guard. And my boss said, well, they pay you for that? He's like, nah, not really, but he said, but they gave you a bonus, $10,000 for signing up. I said, well, I remember thinking, huh?
So this sounds like a decent opportunity for Guillermo. He can get some stability. He can get some money. He's not going to have to hustle anymore after that bonus.
Yeah, it could be a really good thing. Or, more likely knowing him, he already has a plan for those 10 G's. Either way, he calls the recruiter as soon as he can.
I'm like, yo, I would like to join. When can I come see you? He's like, ah, if you want, we got a test tomorrow. So I took the test. I passed it right away. Like, I didn't even study. I passed the test.
He's accepted into the National Guard as a driver. He enlists, and he's set to ship out to basic training in January. But until then, Guillermo's still broke. He remembers being a month late on rent, close to eviction. So he helps out a friend in Providence by moving 80 pounds of weed from New York to Rhode Island. I ask him if he was scared.
See, that's something they say when you're hungry. Hungry overcomes fear. I don't care what no one says. That's why you see people crossing the border. When you're hungry, fear is not, it's not even a choice. It's about shining around here, getting mine around here. Bitches only peep out the signs around here. So hood stars perform when the spotlight is bright to the beat of the drum. Bitches dancing all night.
So he's doing all of this while he's enlisted?
Yeah, he's still in survival mode, and nobody knows. He goes to basic training in January for 8 weeks. He returns to Providence, all ready to be deployed, but that never happens. So he's at home with his friends, his brothers, his $10,000 enlistment bonus, and nothing to do.
You know, I was in the Army, and I had my military state of mind. My mind had changed everything. I was something else. But when I came back, first thing my brothers do is roll up a blunt for me. Plow. At the dances, you can't keep your seat. Some of the money I take, I buy drugs, and I start selling drugs because the money's running out. So what am I going to do? I got to get money.
Only this time, he's not selling weed.
I was selling heroin, but I was breaking stuff down. So it was like I was making enormous profits. Like my profits were so large that it was crazy. Like, yeah, what they do, they got bags. Then 10 bags is a bundle. Then 5 bundles, they call it a brick. So I would sell bricks of that for like about $175. 1 gram is supposed to be 1 brick. But when you become good, I could make 2. Let's say I'm selling every brick for like about 150. So, you know, 10 is 1500, but I'm making double. So the amount of money I was making, it was insane.
If you don't understand that quick drug math, that's okay. But at his peak, Guillermo is making up to $25,000 a week. You don't need to know the specifics to know that Guillermo was making a ton of money.
$25,000 a week? You gotta be kidding me. How is he doing this?
Discipline. He stays close to the phone, waiting for clients to call him. He never trusts anybody else but his brothers to help him. And he never does the drugs that he's selling.
See, back then, when I was doing that, like I was 22, 23 years old, to me, I was just doing what I was supposed to do. That's the way I used to see it. Then, you know, now that I'm old, I look back, I'm like, damn, like I was doing some other shit. Like I had my older brother and his friend, they all hating on me. They didn't like me. I didn't understand why. Every time I would walk in, they would always start, oh, look at your shoes, oh, that cologne, that car. But I back then, I couldn't see what was really going on. Because to me, like I said, I was doing what I was supposed to do.
So does anyone try to slap some sense into him? You know, his parents or someone else in his family?
Well, his dad is in the DR, preoccupied with his political life. But Guillermo's living with his mom, and she does try. She roots through his room one day and finds bags of heroin. She confronts Guillermo.
She pulled me to the side one day. She was like, listen, you're going to have to get a job because I'm not going to fall under your conspiracy. Yeah. And I remember that year, actually, the day after my birthday, I moved out of my mom's house that same year. Yeah, I had to do, I couldn't be, you know, so doing that, all that stuff in there because I was doing a lot and a lot of people knew where I lived and, you know what I'm saying? Yeah, so I had to get out.
He gets his own place, which might seem like he wasn't listening to his mom, but he decides to go to school after that. He uses drug money to pay for it. And he gets a degree in music engineering at a college in Florida. He wants to make it as a big-time hip-hop artist and producer.
Matter of fact, I got a friend of mine. His name is Sway Mendes. When I decided to come back to Providence, he knew what I was going to do. And he was begging me not to. Yo, he used to call me every day. He used to beat me in the head. He's like, yo, don't go back. He's like, yo, you're going to fuck up. He's like, yo, don't. Yo, he used to call me every day for like a week. He'll come show up on my crib. He'll beat me. Mind you, he's younger than me, but he did 3 years already. I've never been to jail. So he kept telling me, yo, don't do it. He's like, yo, it's going to be a mistake. It's going to be a mistake. Yeah, so he was right. It ended up being a mistake.
So he never pursues that music career?
No. It's slow money versus fast money. You can imagine, being a music producer is cool, but it takes a long time to make any money at it. Back in Providence, he can make 25 grand in a week. And he thinks he can get even bigger.
But that's not what happens.
No, it's not.
I was just trying to do too much. You know what I'm saying? I was trying to sell heroin. I was trying to sell coke. I was trying to do everything. Just like do things too fast. You can't move too fast. Not even when you're living the fast life.
He's spread too thin. He starts working with new people. From 2006 to 2008, Guillermo gets arrested a couple of times. The third and final time is for good.
I remember sitting in the federal court over here in downtown Providence, and I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm going through this again. But I knew it was a wrap. I know you don't come out of the feds like that. I know it was over. I know, okay, this is it. I know I was going to sit there for a while.
Catching a federal case is bad for anyone. It means you've committed serious crimes and could spend a lot of time in jail. But it's particularly bad for an immigrant.
Yeah, this is really bad. So for someone like Guillermo, who has legal permanent resident status, this arrest means more than mandatory jail time. It means automatic deportation after serving a sentence. So once he's released from federal prison, he's going to be sent back to the Dominican Republic.
So Guillermo sits in Wyatt Correctional Facility in Central Falls for 14 months, fighting his drug case, all while knowing he's probably going to get deported.
But when you get locked up, the first thing you want to do is get out. Of course, there's nothing else to think about but get out. So people say, nah, you know, they don't know the law. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. If you sign your deportation, they give you less time, this, that, and the third. But me, like, I did not want to get deported. Like, I don't know. Like, I grew up here. Like, I've been here. I was 20 years already. I've been 31 now, but back then, 20 years. So I'm like, yo, what the hell am I going to do? Like,
Guillermo is sleeping in the top bunk in a four-man cell. The ceilings are low, so he writes on them. One night, he writes 809, the area code for the Dominican Republic.
And then I just wiped it off for some reason. I said, nah. And I'm like, nah, not me. Not me.
In that moment, Guillermo decides that whatever happens, he's not getting deported without a fight. But it's not that easy. After 14 months at Wyatt, Guillermo loses his drug case and is sentenced to 72 months in a federal prison in North Carolina.
But when I got to North Carolina and I was going to be there for another 4 years, I remember they put me in the cell. So then they opened up the pod, and I remember walking out of the pod and looking around like, damn, I'm over here for another 4 years. That shit kind of fucked my head up. Yeah, it messed me all up. And I remember walking down on the yard, and they had barbed wire, like, on top. I couldn't even look up. I had to look, like, sneak up and look for a while. For, like, the first couple of months, I couldn't even look at that. It used to mess with my head.
4 years in federal prison, far from any home he ever knew. The pressure gets to him. One day, he gets into a fight and winds up in solitary confinement for 2.5 months. At this point, he's lost virtually everything. No more money, no more flashy clothes, no friends, no freedom. Just him and his thoughts, day in, day out. After almost 80 days, they let him out of the shu and he's focused. He's ready to start making the most of his time in prison. He's going to start figuring out how to stay in the United States.
But how does someone do that when they're in jail?
By going to the place where you can learn how to do anything. The library.
I just know that I ended up going to the library one day. And I go see the clerk. There's another inmate. So inmates, they run everything. So I'm like, I'm trying to fight immigration. He goes, what do you want? I'm like, I don't know, just give me the law book. So he gave me a law book, like, I don't know how many inches, like 6, 7, 8 inches, like thick or whatever. So I just opened the book, started reading on page one. It was first definitions or whatever. Then from there, I started just going into the actual law, the immigration law. Then he saw that I was going every day. He said, listen, we just got a handbook that came in. You want that? I'm like, yeah. So I used to take out the law book and the handbook. And I used to go with like just a piece of paper and I used to just write things out.
He goes to the library every day for the entire morning block before lunch. At first, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just reading every single thing on immigration law he can find.
I said, mother kid, I don't even remember right now. I gotta find the proper case, you know. Wow. System brings back good memories, but it brings back memories.
Back in Guillermo's apartment, he's showing me all the papers he's copied from the library. He keeps them in a tattered post office flat rate envelope and had them on his keyboard, ready to show me when I got there.
I know until you look up this certain law, this is the actual law, and you know, you go to this like immigration, whatever law, and then you look up this subsection. And then you can go to the handbook.
And these papers are stacked with information. Immigration law is dense. But Guillermo's explaining it to me like it's any old thing. He tells me that in 2010, he found a case that was identical to his. But the defendant lost because he didn't fight to change his immigration status from legal permanent resident to citizen.
I was going to use that same argument. And I remember thinking, yo, I hope someone wins this before I get out.
In August of 2013, someone does. The defendant is a man born in Nigeria, last name Enwozuzu. He immigrated to the United States with his parents when he was a kid. They had visas, and his parents became citizens. He did not. He committed a couple of felonies and was set to be deported, but he fought it and he won. Because he proved that he was actually a citizen all along through something called derivative citizenship.
Derivative citizenship. I have no idea what that means.
I didn't either, but it's another thing that my Uber driver taught me. It's a classification of citizenship you can get if you meet the following 3 criteria. 1, you come here when you're a kid. 2, you have parents who become citizens. And 3, you reside permanently in the United States before the age of 18.
So does reside permanently mean the same thing as legal permanent resident or green card holder?
That is the whole issue. And that's how Enwozuzu won his case. His lawyers proved that reside permanently does not inherently mean that someone has a legal permanent resident status. They just needed to live here full time, just like you and I live here full time. So Guillermo reads this crazy, convoluted case and realizes this argument could work for him. Someone has set a precedent. So he finds the name of the lawyer who won it.
Joshua Bar David, an immigration attorney in New York, New York.
Guillermo's dad is living in New York at this point. So Guillermo makes an appointment for his father to go to Josh's office in Tribeca.
The most important and really the only issue in Guillermo's case is what the meaning of reside permanently means. And so the question before Department of Homeland Security is whether or not reside permanently is the same thing as lawful permanent residency.
So let me get this straight. Guillermo's citizenship boils down to what the words permanent and resident mean.
Basically, yes. Because if you remember, Guillermo's mother got her citizenship back in 1997. And Guillermo got his legal permanent resident status, or green card, when he was 19.
But the statute says he needed to get that before he turned 18.
Right. But Josh is arguing that that doesn't matter, because Guillermo lived, or resided, permanently in the United States before he turned 18 and before he got his legal status.
So Guillermo has been a citizen this whole time.
Well, that's what they're trying to prove. Back in prison, Guillermo is hard at work. He establishes residence in New York so Josh can be his lawyer. He applies for a visa to get his derivative citizenship, but he receives an intent to deny his visa from U.S. Customs and Immigration Services.
So they didn't actually deny him the visa. They just told him they were intending to deny it.
Yeah, it's a little ridiculous, I know. But Guillermo is ready. He responds to the intent to deny with a 4-page handwritten letter entitled Response to Intent to Deny. It's as close to cursing somebody out in complex legal jargon as I think you can get. You can practically feel the urgency leaping off the page. It's written in pen with no scratch outs, no whiteout.
So I say Dominican Republic law, BIA case law, and immigration law requires DNA testing to affirm parent-child relationship. Therefore, I derive U.S. citizenship from my mother the moment she filed for my permanent residency. In accordance to subsection 5, I began to reside permanently. So I sent it out on Tuesday. I'm supposed to get released Friday, but ICE picks me up.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, takes Guillermo to their office in Virginia. It's Friday the 13th, no joke, and it's a total shock to Guillermo.
So shouldn't his letter have released him?
Yes. But this is the federal government we're talking about. Efficiency and communication aren't exactly its strong suits. So ICE holds him over the weekend. And Guillermo's worried he's about to get deported.
So I remember I'm taking a shower. I come out of the shower. They calling me. They used to call you by your bunk. I don't remember what bunk I was in. They calling my name, my numbers. I don't care. I'm being a jerk. I'm taking forever to get ready. So when I go up front where the guy was at, that same ICE lady's there. She takes me to the side. She goes, hey, I think you're getting released. And my heart just started racing. Boom, 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 boom. Like, I can barely walk. I'm, like, nervous. And she takes me back down to ICE, and they had all the paperwork ready. I couldn't even believe this was going on. I couldn't even believe it. I'm like, yo, is this shit real? Like, I've been doing this for so many years. Like, is this really happening?
ICE didn't hold him. The letter worked. Guillermo was free to go. On June 16th, 2014... Guillermo leaves ICE custody, boards a bus from Virginia to New York City, and navigates his way to his dad's apartment, where he can begin the next phase of his life.
So it's interesting to me to hear Guillermo talk with all this excitement and emotion about getting released from ICE, because honestly, when he talks about anything else, he has no emotion or sympathy or anything, you know, even his drug selling.
Yeah, the dude has built some serious walls around himself. If he regrets anything about his life, or if he feels remorse for selling heroin, or even if he feels excited about the future, he didn't share that with me. For him, it's always been about money and survival, even now.
It was kind of hard for me to even adjust to, like, getting slow money. I still don't understand how people do it. I'm like, how can people just work in a job and this, that, and the third, not trying to, like, sell drugs, but, like, I'm trying to do it in an illegal way, so I'm learning different things now, how to make money in another way, which I wish I would have known back then, you know what I'm saying?
So he's driving Uber and looking into things like real estate and finance.
But it's not like he's in the clear right now, right, with his immigration case, even in 2019?
Right. It's been 5 years, and Guillermo's immigration case is still open. He's only had 2 hearings since his release in 2014. He has a court date scheduled for December of this year, where the judge will hopefully make a ruling about whether she thinks Guillermo has made a valid claim to derivative citizenship.
Then what happens next?
Then the case goes to the Department of Homeland Security, which will ultimately decide whether Guillermo can stay or go.
And how long does that take?
Impossible to know. The processing times vary greatly. They can be a year, 2 years, 3 years. Especially where there's a complex case, it can even be longer. So there's no way to know for sure. There is no rhyme or reason to when we get a decision.
That means it could be years before Guillermo gets out of immigration purgatory, where he's been his whole life.
Okay, so my guess is a lot of people are thinking right now, why should I care about this guy? He's an unrepentant drug dealer. He's a criminal. We have strict immigration laws to prevent someone like this from staying in the U.S. Why are we wasting so much money, so much time on this guy?
And that's something I've been wrestling with, too. But I'll let Josh take it.
He is not somebody who is, you know, a career criminal. He is somebody who made a huge mistake, but paid his debt, did the time that he was sentenced to by the criminal justice system. And if the criminal justice system thought that, you know, he was a greater risk, he wouldn't be out right now. But at the end of the day, U.S. citizens don't get deported.
Guillermo is a criminal, and he doesn't really care about what he's done. But he changed in prison. Prison took him out of his old life and gave him the opportunity to study the law every single day. He learned that he can work just as hard as he did at selling drugs and be successful at something positive and legal.
And even if you think he's a bad guy, all this mind-numbing legal work that he's doing is actually digging into the very definition of U.S. citizenship. What happens here has the potential to have a huge impact on other immigration cases. He's making a difference that could help set precedent in immigration law.
Exactly. But that hasn't happened yet. So Guillermo waits. He makes beats in his basement apartment. He drives Uber. And he dreams of what his life will be like once his case is finally over.
Mosaic is a production of the Publix Radio, edited by Sally Isley with production help from James Baumgartner and Aaron Selbig. This episode features music by Guillermo Litvinov-Perez and Bryn Bliska. Tori Malatia is the general manager of the Publix Radio. I'm Alex Nunes.
And I'm Ana Gonzalez. Thanks so much for listening. Support for this podcast comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org.